die. Santa Clara was chaotic. I went with Che and his forces to the city at the end of December. Were you and Che friends?
I wouldn't say we were friends. Compatriots by circumstance rather than birth. He came here from Argentina looking for a fight. He wanted to revolutionize the world one country at a time.
He was beloved by many, though, wasn't he?
He was. He had charisma, and his fighters looked up to him.
Pablo shrugs.
I cared more for Cuba than I did about revolution. I dreamed of freedom in those days. Freedom from Batista's tyrannical ways, from our position as America's playground. I wanted the island to be democratic and independent. I wanted the Cuban people to determine their own future. Sometimes I wondered if Che merely liked the fight.
Yet you fought beside him.
I did. We were brothers of sorts. You don't always like your brothers, don't always agree with them, but you take up arms and fight beside them. In those days, it was the right thing to do.
So you went to Santa Clara?
I did. Elisa didn't want me to go. She was afraid something would happen to me, to Cuba, to us. And I didn't want to leave her. But after I got out of prison, after Elisa and your great-grandfather helped get me out, my days were numbered. Batista was determined to make an example of the rebels, and it was only a matter of time before I ended up in front of a firing squad.
Were you scared?
Terrified. In my younger years, I would have told you I was ready to die for my country, that I was brave. It's the prerogative of old men to tell the truth. I was afraid I would die, afraid I would be wounded, afraid I'd never see Elisa again, afraid we'd lose, and all we'd done would be for naught. But on the way, that fear changed. On the way to Santa Clara, people came out of their homes, from the fields where they worked and cheered us along. Their shoes were worn, their clothes dirty, but there was hope in their eyes. They saw us as their future, Cuba's future. And it was impossible to not feel proud on that march, to not feel like we served something greater than us, to not feel some sense of purpose, that if we faced death, it would not be in vain. Young men dream of nothing more than becoming heroes, and we knew that whatever happened in Santa Clara, we would be remembered as heroes or martyrs.
Why did you decide to fight?
I met Fidel when I was studying law at the University of Havana. We had a class together, and we went out for drinks one night after a lecture. He was so passionate back in those days. It was easy to get swept up in his words, in his enthusiasm for change. We were consumed by the idea of dethroning Batista, so caught up in the spirit of the fight that we didn't think as much about the future as we should have. We agreed Cuba should be free, but we didn't realize at that time that we had different views of what that freedom would look like, that the reality would be different from the one we spoke of when we were just kids playing at revolution. I'm surprised by the candor in his voice, by the thread of regret beneath it all.
What would you have done differently?
Everything.
Nothing.
Who knows how much would have changed?
What happened that day in Santa Clara?
I was shot at Santa Clara. There were a few hundred of us. Some went with Che, others, like me, armed with grenades, were sent to capture the hill. El Vaquerito led us.
El Vaquerito?
Roberto Rodriguez Fernandez. He died at Santa Clara. He was only 23. He delivers the words in a matter-of-fact tone of voice, as though he is too familiar with men dying in war. Batista's army had nearly 4,000 soldiers, tanks, planes. We were outmatched and outgunned.
But you won. I saw the memorial, the train.
He seems pleased by this.
We did.
Batista's forces were tired of fighting. When we captured the train Batista sent with reinforcements, it was all over. Batista fled during the early hours of New Year's Day, and everyone marched toward the city. I lost a lot of blood, and my wound became infected. I nearly died. The doctors didn't think it was wise to move me, so I stayed and recovered in a house nearby. In the confusion, Guillermo thought I'd died. By the time I was well enough to contact Elisa, Batista was already gone, and Fidel had taken power. There were strikes throughout the country, and everything descended into a state of chaos. I had to be careful. Her family never would have approved, and at that time I had nothing to offer her. I went to Havana to see her. Before I had a chance, I learned her father was in prison. They were after anyone who supported Batista in those days, and already the regime was discussing taking the plantations away from the elite. The Perez family was an attractive target. I'm struck by the way in which he describes the regime as separate from him, as though Castro's revolution was almost, but not quite, his. He was in La Cabaña, Pablo continues. A chill slides down my spine as I remember the sight of the prison in Havana looming on the horizon. Che had him. I had a few cards to play, and I knew how much Elisa loved her father, that it would have broken her heart to have lost him, that the family depended on him. In the end, it wasn't enough. This is the part of the story I didn't get from the letters Magda or Ana, the missing piece to the puzzle. I met with Elisa's father, your great-grandfather, before he was released, and he promised he would tell her I was safe, that I loved her, that I would come for her when I could, when I had something to offer her. I gave him a letter to give to her. He seemed grateful to me for getting him out, but at the same time, I saw the way he looked at me. I was just another criminal in green fatigues in his eyes. And still, I had hope. That the dream of Elisa, of a future of us together, the one that had sustained me through prison, my time in the mountains, would eventually come true. And then they killed Alejandro, he says, sadness in his gaze. After everything, I couldn't save him. What happened? I grew up knowing that once my grandmother had a brother, but the mention of him was always too painful for her and her sisters to discuss. I didn't know him personally, only what I heard through the rebel circles and my relationship with Elisa. He was well-liked, charismatic, well-placed to influence Cuba's future. He was a threat, and someone took that threat seriously enough to kill him. He wasn't with the 26th of July? No, he wasn't. Those words seem particularly ominous. As soon as I learned Alejandro had been killed, I wanted to see Elisa, to comfort her, and at the same time I worried my presence would be a slap in the face for all they'd lost. So I stayed away for a while, thinking it was the honorable thing to do. Eventually I realized your great-grandfather never told her I was alive, never gave her my letter. I learned Guillermo told Elisa I was dead, that she thought I was gone. I don't blame your great-grandfather, not after all he'd lost. My own family disowned me for joining Fidel. The last words my father said to me were that he was ashamed I was his son, that I had betrayed my country, my people. I didn't want Elisa to feel the same way. Couldn't bear the thought that I'd destroyed what she loved, too. I went to her house to see her once I learned Guillermo had told her I died, once it became clear your great-grandfather didn't tell her I was alive, once some time had passed. I asked one of the gardeners about the family, and he said they had gone, fled to the United States. He didn't know when they would return. That was in March. I told myself she was safer there. You can't imagine the fear we lived with during those days, even those of us close to Fidel. Perhaps those of us close to Fidel more than anyone. It took nothing to sentence a man to death. You learn to survive by following his orders, by agreeing with everything he said. Men who didn't? Good men. Well, his voice cracks, and I see the man my grandmother loved, the earnestness there, and the immense sorrow at all that goodness and hope being twisted into something else entirely. The firing squads. Blood. His eyes close. It wasn't what I believed in. It wasn't the future I had fought for. But I couldn't give up. We'd come too far for the country to fail. The problem was no one really understood what it would take to make the necessary changes in Cuba. And there were so many problems to be addressed. So I stayed behind and I worked. I wanted to help with legal reform. One of the goals of the revolution was to restore Cuba to the 1940 Constitution. Of course, instead we had the fundamental law. I worked every day, I saved, and I made plans. Fidel traveled to New York in September 1960 to address the United Nations, and I was part of the delegation that accompanied him. I went with the hopes that once I was in the United States, I could find Elisa. I knew she was in Florida. I didn't know where she lived, but I found the headquarters of your great-grandfather's sugar company in Palm Beach. It took most of my savings to get there. And when I did, he met with me in his office. From the beginning, some part of me knew Elisa didn't belong with me anymore. She'd never cared about the money. But in having money, I now saw a security I couldn't provide for her. Cuba was in such a state of unrest that it would have been a challenge to protect her, to give her the kind of life she deserved, and I worried. Worried about her being a Perez in a country where it was no longer prudent to stand out for having more than everyone else. Your family was known in Cuba. Elisa and her sisters were known in Cuba. Those were dangerous times to be one of the elite. Fidel had nationalized Cuban industry, the sugar fields. Privately, he was talking about the government seizing the property of those who left. And then your great-grandfather told me the news. That she'd married. He wasn't cruel about it. Quite the opposite, really. He showed me a picture of your grandmother in a wedding dress, standing next to her husband. Pain fills his eyes. She looked happy. Safe. He said they'd fallen in love quickly, had married quickly. They had a child already. What was I supposed to do? She was happy. She had the life she had always wanted, to be a wife and mother. Meanwhile, I fought for a country that was falling down around me. I wasn't the kind of man who would disrupt her life when I had nothing to offer her. There was no honor in such action. So I came back. I worked with Calderillo to form the legal system. Later on, I worked with the law school to shape the new curriculum. He smiles. I met my Julia, and we married. Had children of our own. 6 grandchildren now. It's not the life I imagined for myself, the one Elisa and I dreamed of. But the older you get, the more you learn to appreciate the moments life gives you. Getting them certainly isn't a given, and I feel blessed to have carved out a life here where I could be happy, even if it wasn't quite the happiness I envisioned. If the things I dreamed of never quite came to pass. I have a feeling he's not just talking about my grandmother anymore. He gestures toward my hand. May I? I nod, sliding the ring off my finger and placing it in his hands. Emotions swim in his eyes. It was my grandmother's. He smiles again. I didn't have much money back then, but I wanted to make Elisa a promise. One she could believe in. So I gave her my grandmother's ring. Elisa couldn't wear it on her hand, of course, so when we weren't together she wore it on a chain around her neck, near her heart. Would you like it back, if it's a family heirloom? He shakes his head, placing the ring back in my palm. It was meant for you. He's quiet for a moment. You don't just have the look of Elisa, you know. I see my mother in you, too. I still. My heart thudding. When did you realize? I ask. When I saw the ring. Then I recognized my mother in your face. A tear trickles down his cheek. Do I have a son or a daughter? A son. Tell me about him, please. So I do. I tell him about my family. Half of my heart here. Half of it with Luis, praying for his safety. Waiting for Pablo's man to come tell us what's to become of him. Will you tell them about me? Pablo asks once I've finished, and I sense the hesitation behind the question. Recognizes fear that he won't be accepted because of his political allegiances. The revolution has divided so many families. It's wrecked ours enough. Yes. Do you think they'll want to know me? He asks, the uncertainty in his voice tugging at my heart. I do. A knock sounds at the door, and Pablo excuses himself. He opens the door and exchanges murmured words with a man from earlier. When they're finished, he returns to me. It's safe for you to go back to Ana's tonight. They're still questioning Luis, but I'm working on getting him out. I need to meet with a friend who might be able to help us. The word us is incredibly reassuring. Do you think you can secure his release?
I hope I can.
I promise you, Marisol. I'll do everything in my power to make it happen.
Chapter 27. I take a cab back to Ana's in a daze, relaying the events to her, Caridad, and Cristina. They receive the news of Luisa's arrest with resignation and a sense of calm that would have shocked me if I hadn't grown used to this Cuban pragmatism. I tell Ana privately about Pablo, that he's my grandfather, my hope that he will be able to help Luis.
What do we do?
I ask once I've finished the tale.
We wait, Ana answers, her expression grim.
The next morning, Luis is still not back with us, and I walk to my grandfather's house in Miramar, to the address he gave me the previous night. Worry in my heart as I approach his home.
What if he's not here?
What if he can't help me or he changed his mind once he realized the precariousness of Luis's position? I'm staking a lot on the letters, on the fact that my grandmother loved him, the time I spent in his presence, on the hope that he'll be able to do something to get Luis out of this mess. A mere block marks the difference between Pablo's house and the one my grandmother grew up in. He must drive past the old Perez estate every single day. Does he think of her often? The house is ahead of me. The well-manicured lawn, immense palm trees swaying gently in the breeze, and elegant exterior a surprise. My grandfather's stature in life seems to have changed quite a bit from that of the staunchly middle-class lawyer described in his letters, and his home is in far better condition than its compatriots. Some are more equal than others. I press on the gate, the iron creaking as it swings open. The sound of the ocean mixes with the noise of children laughing and yelling somewhere on the property's immense grounds. There's an entire family out there I never knew. I continue forward, my sandals slipping against the rock driveway, my legs wet noodles. I reach the front steps and hesitate. I close my eyes, offering a silent prayer to the heavens, and the one person I know absolutely has my back up there, as I knock on the heavy wood door and wait until it opens, revealing an elderly Cuban woman in a flowered dress.
May I help you? She asks. Is this his wife?
I swallow.
I'm Marisol Ferreira.
I'm here to see Mr. Garcia.
She's silent for a moment, her gaze assessing.
He's sitting out on the back porch. I'll show you the way. I follow her through the house, my gaze on the paintings on the wall, the furnishings. Nothing is in luxurious condition by American standards, and yet the pieces have clearly fared far better than at the Rodriguez home. Does my grandfather have someone else's family legacy hanging on his walls?
The woman leads me to a covered outdoor area with a breathtaking view of the sea and sky, a storm out over the water. She asks me if I would like a drink, and I decline.
My grandfather sits in an oversized chair under the covered space, smoking a cigar, a glass of amber liquid in front of him. He wears a sharp Panama hat, another guayabera, the hem of his shirt blowing in the breeze, and black pants. Pablo sets his glass down. He rises from his chair, his hand gripping the arm, his eyes on me as he exchanges affectionate words with his wife, before she's gone, closing the doors and leaving us alone on the patio overlooking the sea. The rain slaps the tile patio beyond the covering.
What's happening with Luis?
I ask. They're attempting to charge him under social dangerousness, my grandfather replies.
What does that mean?
The people who have been tried under the charge have been imprisoned for several years. Occasionally, the government will go for something a bit lighter, like house arrest. But in this instance, that's best case. The law allows the government to detain someone if they think they may commit a crime in the future. They have applied it against dissidents in the past. And that's what they're aiming for in this case. Because he works at the university, their concern is his influence over his students, his opportunity to organize them, to create a movement against the government. My grandfather sighs. At the moment, he's being held in a cell alone. But when he's in prison, things can happen. He's not safe there. I had hoped he would be released by now, but I fear things are worse than I imagined.
What can happen to him?
He will get into fights. People are killed.
Even before he's in prison, things will be dangerous. His voice lowers to a whisper. People disappear. Have the misfortune to be involved in a car accident on their way home. This is not America. Once you are in the regime's sights, you are not safe. If they think he's dangerous enough, they will do whatever they have to in order to silence him. What do I do? Get him a lawyer? Get the Americans involved? Human rights groups? Who can help him? Will they even care? Or is he just one Cuban in a long line of human rights abuses? I'm waiting to hear back from a few friends, well-placed in the judicial system. I'm trying to get him out, but it's complicated, and we must be very careful in how we handle this. I know you're scared, but Marisol, you also need to be careful. If they think you're involved, if they can create a connection that makes it appear as though you're involved, they can try you as a spy. You can get caught up in this too. These are dangerous times, and your nationality will only afford you so much protection. My great-aunt's earlier warnings return to me now. I know you want to help, but you have to understand that there are limits here, Pablo adds. You must be smart about this. Wait at Ana's house, and when I know something, I'll come to you. There's nothing you can do to get him out until then, and your intervention will only make things worse. Promise me you'll wait. It's a hard pill to swallow, but the logical, rational part of me knows he's right. And if Ana, Caridad, and Cristina can be stoic about this, I must be as well. I promise. This man, he's important to you, yes? He is, I swallow. Will he be okay? My grandfather's expression is grim. I hope so. The next few hours creep by with agonizing slowness. Life doesn't stop because Luis is in jail. The Rodriguez women still prepare meals, taking in guests. The kitchen quiet as a tomb save for the occasional piece of silverware scraping against a plate, a pot banging against the stovetop, the hiss and boil of water. The urge to cry is a battering ram weakening my defenses, and yet there is an unspoken agreement here. Luis's grandmother, his mother, Cristina, none of them break. There's a tremor in their hands, the occasional hitch in their throat, but they don't cry. No one objects when I join them in the kitchen, helping to make the picadillo for the evening meal. Valedar is full tonight. The table's packed with tourists, Canadians, two Australian couples, and a French family. Cristina and Caridad serve the guests with somber expressions and trays laden with food. I worry most about Ana. When the other two women are out serving guests, she allows the facade to slip a bit, murmuring prayers and rubbing the bracelet on her wrist as though it's a rosary. Would you like to lie down? I ask. My cooking skills aren't on par with Ana's, but picadillo is a staple in the Cuban diet. I've helped my grandmother make it hundreds of times, and it's one of my few culinary achievements. Thank you, but no. It helps me to stay busy, to keep my mind from wandering. Me too. She reaches over and squeezes my hand. You'll be okay, she proclaims, her hand drifting to her chest, a beat above her heart. I feel it here. We cook in silence, working in tandem to create the picadillo. When I press Ana to eat some herself, she waves me off and says I should eat instead. My stomach is too full of nerves and worry for me to bother with food, and we continue on in the tiny space. Cristina and Caridad drift in and out of the kitchen, returning to serve the guests. Someone pounds at the front door. We both still. Ana's gaze darts toward the kitchen entrance and back to me. Her hands drift to the bracelet again, her fingers flying over the beads. Will you come with me? I nod. The words stuck in my throat. I take her hand and we walk toward the door together. When we reach the front door, I pause. Do you think we should... wait, get help? A litany of objections run through my mind before I remember this is Cuba, and the rules here work differently. There is no media to highlight these abuses, no government to complain to, no friend or neighbor to call upon to aid us. We are really and truly alone with only ourselves to rely on. Ana straightens, pushing her shoulders back. her fingers fumbling with the lock on the door. She swings it open. Luis and my grandfather stand on the other side. The sight of Luis is a shock, even more so because of the condition he's in. His lip is swollen, a fresh bruise on his cheekbone, a cut near his jaw, his beard matted with blood. His arm hangs at his side, his torso hunched over as though damage has been done there, too. They cross the threshold, and Anna closes the door behind them. I step forward, wrapping my arms around Luis, careful to keep my touch gentle, to avoid doing further injury to him. I pull back, searching his expression, my gaze running over his face for more injuries I might have missed.
"Are you okay?" I ask. "What happened?"
"I'm okay," he answers, his voice weak. I step back while Anna hugs him, her voice full of worry and love.
"Did you get him out?"
I ask my grandfather. When I went to him for help, I didn't expect such quick results.
"For now. Is there somewhere we can talk? Somewhere private?"
Anna nods and takes us to the small sitting room off the entryway. When the door shuts, my grandfather fills us in on the rest of it.
"Officially, it'll look like he was accidentally released. It happens. Clerical errors, overcrowded jails and prisons. People get lost in the shuffle. It's not going to buy much time, though."
He turns his attention to Luis.
"You have a passport, yes?"
Luis gives a clipped nod in return.
"I thought it was a prudent move when they removed the ban on foreign travel. I don't miss the way he says they, or the look he gives my grandfather when he says it.
At the same time, there's a wary trust in Luis's eyes, and I've no doubt my grandfather told Luis about his relationship to me."
"Good," Pablo answers. "Then you can go from Havana to Antigua. Buy a return ticket. Marisol can help you. The fare will be high, but they won't require you to have a visa to get into the country. There's no time to get you a visa to fly to a country that will require one. Hopefully, at the airport, they will think you are going on vacation."
"Won't they flag his passport at the airport, though?" I interject.
"At the moment, there is nothing to flag. You've disappeared from the records. It won't last long, though. Once you're in Antigua, you'll want to get a plane to the United States," Pablo continues. "That will be difficult, but with enough money, not impossible." He turns to me. "Marisol will need to help you with the rest of it. You'll need to charter a plane to take you from Antigua to Miami, and to sort out his entry into the United States. Can you do that?"
"Honestly, I have no clue. But at the moment, we seem to have few options available to us."
"I think so.
My father's company has a plane he uses for business. My family will help." "Once, it was enough that if we could get Luis to the United States, he would be offered refuge. Under the decades-old wet-foot, dry-foot policy, Cubans who were captured in the water were sent back to Cuba by the Coast Guard. Cubans who reached American soil could stay. Now, thanks to recent politics, things are more complicated." My grandfather's expression turns grim.
"You need to understand something, Marisol.
They can arrest you on suspicion of even helping Luis leave the country. They know you're here as a journalist, that you're staying with the Rodriguez family. You could be in just as much trouble as Luis. And if you aren't successful, and they catch you, they can throw you in prison for a very long time. There are few offenses the government takes more seriously than helping a Cuban leave the country illegally. I don't take lightly my grandfather's warning, or the risk he's taking himself by helping us. But at the same time, how can I not help get Luis out of Cuba?"
"We're not doing this. She's not doing it," Luis interjects.
"She's risking her freedom and her life? No."
"You don't get to make that decision for me," I protest. "If we're caught, then we won't get caught."
My heart pounds. "There's no way I'm leaving you here to die. Part of why you're in this trouble is because I helped bring your work to their attention."
"Bullshit," Luis snaps. "You need to think about this, Marisol," my grandfather cautions. "Luis is right. It's a risk. A dangerous one."
"Aren't you putting yourself at risk as well?" I ask my grandfather.
"I'm an old man. How many years do I have left? I've served the regime well for a long time, and I've accumulated enough influence."
His smile is wry. "It's the right thing to do. then don't expect me not to do the same. I came here searching for my family's legacy, and now I know what it is. I grew up on their stories, but it was different hearing my grandmother and her sisters recount their experiences. They spoke of their own bravery in a matter-of-fact tone, as though it was something they did that anyone would have done in their position. But now I've seen a sliver of what they lived through up close. The grace with which they bore their suffering. The strength with which they carried our family and our future on their backs. They sacrificed and risked their lives for those they loved, for their country. They were brave when it mattered most. How can I not honor their legacy?
Marisol, Luis interjects.
We'll talk about it later, I answer. I turn toward my grandfather.
You think this could be successful?
There's no guarantee it will work, but it's the best chance you have,
my grandfather answers.
But we need to move quickly. Luis will be back on their radar soon. These things can only be covered up for so long. They've had people keeping an eye on you since you arrived in the country, Marisol.
I had them momentarily reassigned, but it will only buy you a day or two at the most.
And my family? What about them? Luis asks, his mouth in a tense line.
Our earlier conversations come to mind. His reluctance to leave. His fear that his actions will put his family at risk.
These are difficult times for the regime, my grandfather answers. There is international scrutiny that wasn't there before, and also an element of unpredictability in their relations with the United States.
They need to have a better relationship with the United States.
You know this as well as I do.
Things will not change overnight. Human rights will not change overnight.
But Raúl is not stupid. Cuba needs to make some semblance of overture to the United States. The government needs to be careful about which battles they choose to fight.
And given Luis's grandfather's prior relationship with the regime, his father's heroism in Angola, and Marisol's connection to the United States, they can't afford for the situation to become exacerbated. I've spoken to some friends in the government and impressed the gravity of the situation upon them.
Your family will not be harmed, Luis. I give you my word. I've called in all the favors I can to assure it. But you have to leave. The more you push, the harder they'll push back. If you disappear, they will move on and forget you. But if you stay...
How can you stay? I ask Pablo. How can you support what they're doing?
I'm grateful for his help, but I can't reconcile the man who seems to have such a good heart with a government official involved in such corruption.
You have to know this is wrong.
Is it better to stay and become part of the system? Or leave and be considered a traitor, my grandfather replies.
A worm? I do not know.
If I leave, what will change? If I stay, what will change? I have tried to be a counterbalance to some of the more extreme notions that have arisen over the years. Tried to preserve the rule of law. This is my home, imperfect though it is. I have to believe, hope. There is still some good I may do. Some change I may effect to help Cubans. That has to be enough now. I do not begrudge those who live abroad now, who found the situation such that they could not stay. Please do not judge me for the fact that I cannot leave.
You're still fighting.
I am. Revolutions are for the young. When I could, I fought for what I believed in. But I'm an old man now.
The older you get, the more you realize that change, meaningful, lasting change, doesn't always come with violence and bloodshed, but with reform, however slow, however gradual.
When I was young and rash, I believed the only way to defeat Batista was to kill him, to take his country and government away from him by force.
But now?
The problem with revolution, with the wave of violence it carries with it, is that it's like a flash flood. It sweeps everything away, and nothing looks the same as it once did.
And you think this is good. Change was what you wanted in the first place.
Change was what you needed. But suddenly you have a country you must govern, people whose basic needs must be met. You must stabilize a currency and create a legal system and reform a constitution. Those are not the things young men dream of.
They dream of dying for their country. Dream of honor in battle. No one dreams about sitting at a desk and arguing over phrases. But those words, those laws, that infrastructure is everything. Without them, no government can succeed. I am not blind to what my countrymen are suffering, Marisol, or the problems that exist. But I am here, with my pen. The revolution we need now will be fought by those arguing over words, phrases, passing legislation and loosening restrictions. Men willing to sit at a table and discuss the things we've been afraid to address for many, many years. I am meant to be here, to finish what I started, and hopefully to be part of that change. For my family, for my country. That's the gap between him and my grandmother. She could not have lived in this world he created, and he could not leave it. He turns to Luis. The longer you stay, the less I'll be able to do for you. The more restricted your movements will become, the more danger to Marisol. You need to leave tomorrow. Marisol can get you a flight, and I have all the exit paperwork sorted out for you. We have a small window of time in which we can blame your release and departure as a clerical error, the product of departments not speaking with one another. The longer you wait, the greater the chance that you will be picked up by the police, that you will be prevented from leaving the country. If you're picked up again, I can't help you. You will be dealt with swiftly and mercilessly. He's going, Anna replies, speaking for the first time, her fingers on the bracelet again. Abuela. We'll discuss it later, she says, her tone firm. Her gaze turns to my grandfather, tears welling in her eyes. Thank you. Thank you for what you have done for my grandson. He bows. Of course. If you'll excuse me, I need to get home. My wife will be worried. He turns to face me. Marisol, I would very much like to see you before you leave. The reality that we're leaving so quickly hits me. I thought I would have a couple more days here, but now it's all unraveling. Will you meet me at the Malecón tonight? I ask him. There's something I need to do. Of course. Chapter 28. After my grandfather leaves, Luis and I retreat to his bedroom with a makeshift first aid kit in hand. My fingers sweep across his face, careful to keep from hitting the bruises, the cuts near his eye. He unbuttons his shirt, his knuckles scraped and bleeding. I suck in a deep breath. What did they do to you? His hands tremble over the buttons. Trust me, you don't want to know. He shrugs off the shirt, the bloody fabric hitting the floor. I gasp. Bruises mar his torso, a particularly nasty one dangerously close to his kidneys. You could have been killed. I'm fine. You're not fine. They could have killed you, and there's nothing we could have done about it. Nothing you can do about it. Do you realize how crazy that is? They just wanted to scare me a bit. If they wanted to kill me, they would have. And the next time? You heard what my grandfather said. You have to stop. What you're doing is dangerous. It's going to get you killed. Is it worth it? Of course it is. Whatever they hoped to beat out of him, I fear they've only made it stronger. It has to be. It's one of those moments when blinding clarity hits me and two halves cleave together. Like my grandmother before me, I've fallen in love with a revolutionary. I feel the same helplessness she must have felt, the same sensation that we're on a train hurtling off the tracks, and there's nothing I can do to stop it. I don't know what to say anymore. How to convince him he has to leave. I can't fathom living in a world where you have no rights, where there is no oversight, no accountability. The United States isn't perfect. There's injustice everywhere I turn. But there's also a mechanism that protects its citizens. The right to question when something is wrong. To speak out. To protest, to be heard. It doesn't always work. Sometimes the system fails those it was designed to protect. But at least that opportunity, the hope of it, exists. The ability to crush a voice is staggering here. Do you really think you can change the government? That they're going to let you? I dab the wounds on his face with the antiseptic. Luis hisses as I touch the cut near his cheekbone.
I see the hope for change everywhere I look. The undercurrent of it running through Cubans' daily lives, he says. They know this isn't enough, that we deserve more. They dream of little changes that would make their lives easier, make their children's lives easier. Most of us remember when things were really bad, when it was a challenge to get enough to eat, and we remember the desperation we felt, the gnawing hunger in our bellies, the weakness in our muscles, in our bones, and the willingness to break the law because otherwise we would quite simply die. We're dying a different death now, one that isn't physical, he continues. We need to keep putting pressure on the government, keep pushing for change, demanding they do better. They should fear us. We have a generation now that looks ahead and isn't pleased with what they see. My students, the future of this country, they care about technology, what little they're able to access through legal means or not. They care about popular culture, which is smuggled to them through flash drives and in foreigners' suitcases. They are pragmatic in their desire for change, for more. For now, they're occupying themselves with the fight, with gathering all they can on the black market, with changing their own realities. But what happens when they've exhausted their limited resources? What then? Isn't that what I admired most about him? What attracted me to him in the first place? The passion, the commitment, the absolute dedication and love for his country. The men I know in Miami are obsessed with what kind of car they drive, or the brand of watch they wear, what club they're going to on a Saturday night. Luis lives for Cuba, and I love him for it, but now I fear Cuba will kill him. I continue patching his wounds, soothing his bruises, struggling to keep the worry from my voice, to stifle the fear. I understand that you want to make those changes. I admire your passion. But what if the limitations imposed by the government are too stringent for you to accomplish those goals? I don't know. But what you're asking me to do, it's not in my nature to give up. To run. I don't want to risk you in order to do it. It's too late for that. In their eyes, I'm probably already a threat. And don't consider it giving up or running. Call it a strategic retreat. I'm abandoning my country, my family, my people. My father died fighting for what he believed in, and I'm running away to save myself. How can I live with that? My heart breaks for him, because I understand the responsibility he carries with him, the desire to honor his family and to live up to the sacrifices they made. And at the same time, the chasm between us has never felt greater than it does now. The sand stretching on to an infinitesimal length, the sea boundless. 90 miles feels like an impassable distance. If you die, things won't be better. What will your family do then? At least if you're alive, you can send them money. More than they would make here. You can make a difference from outside of Cuba. Perhaps more of one than you would make inside the country with all the restraints the government imposes upon you. You want me to go with you?
I do.
Because you love me, or because you think it's the right decision? Luis asks. How has he known this when I only just worked it out myself?
Because I love you, and I think it's the only decision. His eyes close for a moment when the word love leaves my lips, as though he's absorbing the force of that word, as if I've hit him with a physical blow. His eyes open.
I'm not afraid to die for what I believe in.
Maybe not.
But what does your death accomplish?
You wouldn't be the first one, and you won't be the last, and what changes?
Nothing.
I would rather you be alive in the United States than dead in Cuba.
He makes an impatient noise.
You don't understand. You speak as though Cuba is just a place to live, as though it's nothing more than taking a few boxes and moving them from one house to the next. It's not. This is my home. My country. How can you love a country that does this to its citizens? A government willing to throw you in prison for speaking out against their abuses? I came here wanting to love Cuba. I told myself I would look at it through clear eyes, that I wouldn't be swayed by Miami's view, that I would judge it on its merits and not through the lens of the exile. I can't. I'm Cuban, too. Perhaps I wasn't born here, but my blood is Cuban. How can you fight to stay somewhere where you are not wanted, in a place that will get you killed? You're a smart man. It makes no sense. Where is the logic? But love is not logical. It is my weakness, perhaps. But it is my country. How do I not love it? But at what cost? When you love something, you don't count the cost. And me? Luis smiles sadly. You know I love you, Marisol. Do not ask me to choose between who I love and who I am. I fear it would not reflect well on either one of us. I'm not asking you to choose. There is no choice. They've made the choice for you. You cannot stay here and live, and death is not a continuation. It is not a way of fighting them. Your death will mean nothing. You can do more good alive in Miami than dead in Havana. The exile's refrain. So what if it is? At least we've preserved a version of Gula that does not exist in this place. We're the only ones who've preserved it. You cannot live in a museum, Marisol. The problem with your preservation is that it fails to account for the fact that there is a real Cuba. A living, breathing Cuba. You're all so busy fighting imaginary ghosts in Miami while we're here, bleeding on the ground, dealing with real problems. Your exile community isn't concerned with the black market, or the housing shortage, or the very real flaws in the much-touted education system, or the fact that racial discrimination occurs on a daily basis. You're still pissed because your grand mansions were taken away and are now occupied by the very men you hate the most. The rest of us are caught in the middle, worrying about how to survive. So teach us. Come to Miami. Get involved with the movement there. Change the narrative. The discourse is changing. Fidel is dead. The enmity toward the regime is turning to a very practical approach on Cuba. We're on the cusp of a new era in Cuban-American relations. Perhaps there's an opportunity for something better. That article I'm writing? What if it wasn't about travel? What if it was about contemporary Cuba? What if you told your story? Help us. Teach us about the problems facing Cuba now. It still feels like I'm abandoning my country. It's already abandoned you. This isn't your country, or your grandmother's. It's Castro's. And now his ghosts. It was supposed to be yours. That was the promise of 59, but they broke that promise almost from the beginning. This version of Cuba belongs to the regime, but that doesn't mean the future has to. Retreat is a victory of sorts. You can't win this battle, not like this. You're not giving up, just giving yourself a better chance to change the system in a world where you don't have to play by their rules. He shakes his head. Marisol. His tone is resigned, but there's a gleam in his eyes that wasn't there a few minutes ago. You know I'm right. Perhaps, he acknowledges. We have to make do with the opportunities that present themselves. We have a chance to get you out. We need to take it. He's quiet for a long beat. The only noise in the room, the sound of our breathing. The whirl of the ceiling fan overhead. And then... I know. I run into Cristina on my way out. She's sitting on the steps, smoking a cigarette, staring out at the rusted metal gate at the entryway. You want him to leave with you, she says, her tone flat, not bothering to glance at me. I guess Ana filled Cristina and Caridad in on the conversation with my grandfather. I'm exhausted from my talk with Luis, with the events of the last few days. My grandmother's ashes await in my bag, and more than anything, I don't have much fight left in me. Yes. She takes another drag of her cigarette, the smoke billowing in the air. Why? Because you love him? There's no anger in her voice. The words are delivered in a flat, unemotional tone. Yes. I'm sorry, I add, knowing as soon as the apology leaves my lips that it rings hollow and inadequate, even as it's all I have. Love feels like a luxury here in this world, where divorced couples are forced to live together because there is no housing, because the government makes it so. Love feels like a luxury in a world where so many struggle for the basic things I take for granted. Do you? I ask. What? Love him? I nod. He's a good man. Kind, hard-working, she answers. What alternatives do I have? I ask, the doubts creeping in. Am I being selfish? Or is leaving truly the only answer available to him? He'll kill him if he stays. I love him, yes, but this isn't about me. It's about his future. She scoffs. It must be so nice for him to have a wealthy American woman who's willing to make his life easier. Her gaze pins me. The condemnation in her eyes strips me bare. Do you think this is the first time I've heard this story? Do you know how many of my friends have dreamed of a man who would take them away from this? Have ended up pregnant and abandoned, or worse? Perhaps the roles are reversed, but you're just another rich foreigner making promises. What will he know of your world? What will your rich American friends think of him? It's not like that, I protest. Are the differences between us simply insurmountable? Isn't it, though? Isn't it exactly like that? You come here and you spend a few days in Cuba and tell yourself you've fallen in love, that you're saving Luis, and then you return to your nice, safe life in America, far away from all this. You say you want to be Cuban. Her hands wave in the air, the cigarette dangling between her fingertips, ash falling to the ground. This is what it means to be Cuban. To be a woman in Cuba is to suffer. What do you know of suffering? I don't. Not like this. What would you have me do? I ask. Nothing. I wouldn't have you do anything. But you're all complaining about how you lost your country, and the reality is you didn't lose your country, you left. You left the rest of us in hell, and now he's leaving right alongside you. Would you rather him stay here and die? My frustration isn't with Cristina. It's with this whole situation. But at the moment, she's voicing the things I fear the most. She takes a drag of her cigarette. No. Then what will you have me do? I ask again. You don't want him to leave, but he cannot stay, so what solution is there? Her smile mocks me. Is that what it's like in your world? Do things get wrapped up in pretty little bows and happy endings? You go back to America with Luis. You get married and have children and have your perfect little life together. But deep down, you have to know you won't have all of him. I tried to make him choose between me and Cuba, and he chose Cuba every single time. No matter how much you love him, how much you think he loves you, a part of him will always be here. And a part of him will always resent you for taking him away. Maybe. Maybe the parts of him are enough. Maybe things will change and it won't have to be a choice anymore. I stand there looking down at her sitting on the steps, the straps of her sandals worn, her expression hardened to steel. This island will break your heart if you let it. You could leave too, you know. She laughs, the sound unvarnished and raw. Find some nice man who tells me he wants to take me away from this place and leaves me with a swollen belly and a disease or two? No thanks. We could try to get you out, all of you. Scorn fills her gaze. I tried once. Did Luis ever tell you that? No. I was 6. There were 20 of us in a raft. My parents and 15 others died. We spent a week floating in the water, starving, exhausted before the Coast Guard picked us up and brought us back to Fidel. The adults were thrown in prison. I was sent to live with my grandmother. I'll take my chances, thank you very much. I'm rooted to this spot. Some part of me wanting to stay and convince her, another part of me already gone. I have to go. My grandfather is waiting for me at the Malecón. Then go. When I reach the gate, I turn around, watching as she snuffs out the cigarette on the steps of the house, her gaze trained somewhere out to the sea. What does it say about a place that people will risk certain death to leave it? I walk from the Rodriguez house to the Malecón. My conversation with Cristina running through my head on repeat. Luis is with his mother and grandmother, discussing the logistics of him leaving. And I'm here, finally fulfilling my grandmother's last wishes, the reason I came to Cuba. Waves crash against the rocks at El Moro, the sun setting on another Havana day. My grandfather stands next to me, staring out at the sea. And I wonder how many times he did this, and whether he searched for her somewhere beyond the horizon when he did. I don't realize I've asked the question aloud until he speaks. I imagined her there, America, as a wife, a mother, with the life we always dreamed about. A house full of kids somewhere with a palm tree in the backyard. I imagined her aging as I have. Each year that passed, I thought of her. He sighed. It was enough to hope that she was happy. I hate that their story doesn't have a happy ending. That ultimately, this is yet another thing Fidel took from them. It feels incomplete, I murmur. Life so often is. It's messy, too. This isn't the ending, Marisol. When you're young, life's punctuation so often seems final when it's nothing more than a pause. When I learned Elisa had married, I thought our story had ended, accepted it, and now, almost 60 years later, you're here. I have a granddaughter, a son, a new family, a piece of Elisa. You never know what's to come. That's the beauty of life. If everything happened the way we wished, the way we planned, we'd miss out on the best parts. The unexpected pleasures. He shrugs, gesturing around him. We all had a vision. We had a plan. Fate, God, Fidel, they all laughed at that plan. I thought I was on one path, and it turned out to be something else entirely. That doesn't mean it's all bad, though. He smiles, wrapping his arm around me, bringing me against his side. I'm glad we found each other, I say. He stares up at the sky, a gleam entering his gaze. I like to think Elisa's up there smiling down at us, that she brought us together because she wanted us to meet, wanted you to be part of my life. He begins speaking as if his words are the continuation of a conversation he is having with himself, a memory. She was wearing this dress. He smiles. White. It had this full skirt, and it swayed when she walked. I couldn't stop watching her hips, he confesses, with a look in his eyes that makes him appear decades younger. I laugh. I brought her a white silk rose. I'll never forget her smile when I gave it to her. We were both so nervous. I kept shoving my hands in my pockets because I didn't know what to do with them, because there wasn't anything I wanted more than to take her hand in mine and never let go. The night kept growing later, and I knew we'd have to part soon, and I didn't want to leave her, didn't want to ever let her go. Did you fall in love with her here on the Malecón? Perhaps. Perhaps I fell in love with her that first moment I saw her, standing on the fringes of Guillermo's party, her expression so earnest. Once Elisa burst into my life, there wasn't a moment when I didn't love her. She was a bright spot in years that were filled with violence and bloodshed. She gave me hope. What was she like when you knew her? I ask him. Fierce, passionate, loyal, brave, smart. She cared about people, and she cared about her country. There was a kindness to her. She always wanted to see the best in everyone around her. So little changed between the girl he knew and the woman who raised me. I reach into my bag, removing the container of ashes, my fingers leaving shadowy prints on the cool metal. I would be lying if I didn't admit that this feels a bit unsettling, the act of holding my deceased grandmother in my hands a bit macabre. And at the same time, a weight rolls off my shoulders, as I cast off the mantle of grief that has lain there for so long. I will always miss her, but I've been given a new chance to know her, and through her, a whole new family. A pause in what felt like an ending. And this, too, is right. Her reunion with the man she loved and the country that forever held her heart. I pass the container to my grandfather. A tear slips down his weathered face as he strokes the metal. A tremor in his fingers. Are you sure you don't want to do this? He asks. I shake my head, understanding what was missing before, why I couldn't come up with a final resting place that felt right, It wasn't a place. It was a person. I brought her back to Cuba. The final